So I want to start off by asking, what is the problem with quantum gravity? Why is this a difficult problem? Why is it one of the most important problems in sort of contemporary theoretical physics? So I want to know, why is it so hard to solve? And you know, the basic statement that most of us are familiar with is that gravity is a non-renormalizable theory as a quantum field theory. So this is the Einstein-Hilbert action. It has some coupling constant. That coupling constant has positive dimensions of length. And therefore, in order to specify the theory in the ultraviolet, you know, at every order, I have new counterterms that I need to add. They have all undefined finite contributions. And so in the end, the theory is not predictive, that I have all of these finite contributions I need to specify, and I can't make new predictions. It's important to say, though, that there's also many things that we can do with quantum gravity. So it's good to be clear about what the problem with quantum gravity is not, and that as an effective theory at low energies, you know, perturbatively quantized gravity is really a great framework for doing calculations. There's many things that we're perfectly able to calculate, and so at low energies, we really only need to specify some finite number of counterterms to calculate something to a, you know, a desired accuracy, and that the higher order terms are all suppressed by powers of the cutoff. And so doing perturbative quantum gravity is really not the problem with quantum gravity when we talk about why this is such a hard thing to do. And so I think the problem of quantum gravity then has been historically seen or historically thought of as really the problem of finding the correct ultraviolet completion to the perturbative dynamics that we understand. So there's an enormous body of work that has attempted to do this over the years. I'm not even going to begin to attempt to make reference to all of them. But I think much of this work is really very strongly rooted in the framework of classical gravity. It's very rooted in trying to understand, you know, how to quantize general relativity, or how to, you know, how to make some sensible perturbation theory that is UV complete. And so I think one can generally see most of these ideas as trying to understand a UV complete theory of metrics, or, you know, a UV complete theory of geometry. And there's many sort of general schemes on how one might go about that idea. So what you might want to do is take your geometry and you might try to modify that geometry in the ultraviolet. So you discretize it, you turn it into a lattice, you turn it into a tensor. Or you might take the spectrum of your theory and you might modify the spectrum in the ultraviolet. I don't want to suggest that these are sort of two completely separate things. Obviously, they're very related to each other. But probably many of the approaches to quantum gravity that we're familiar with sort of fall into generally one of these schemes or the other, very naturally. However, I think in most of these approaches, in almost all of these approaches, I think the single most important fact about any theory of quantum gravity has really been obscured, is hidden in the choice of fundamental variables. And that fact, I think the most important fact about gravity, is that gravity is a hologram. So although our universe appears to be 3 plus 1 dimensional, I think what is necessarily true is that the microphysics behaves as if it was not a gravitational theory, but a more ordinary quantum system that lives in one less dimension, in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And from this microscopic perspective, there is some extra dimension that is an emergent property of the theory. And so if I want to describe, say, some region of space-time, I really should describe it by some, you know, discretized theory, perhaps, that lives on its boundary and not in the volume of that region. It's worthwhile to just recall the basic principles about why we should believe this is the case. So it goes back to the 1970s when it was shown that black holes behave thermodynamically. They Hawking radiate at some temperature, say, 1 over the mass in 4 dimensions, and they obey a first law, so that the differential of the mass is just the Hawking temperature times the differential of the area. This is a very familiar kind of first law equation. It is the very same type of first law as we see in thermodynamics. And so the first law of black hole thermodynamics implies that there's a microscopic entropy of black holes that goes like its area. This entropy is unlike most familiar quantum field theories that we're used to. So you take some sort of lattice system, say we have a bunch of spins on a lattice, and I ask, you know, what are the number of degrees of freedom in some region? The number of degrees of freedom in this region scale like the volume. They don't scale, say, like the number of spins on the perimeter. And so this is some very peculiar, exotic theory. It's not like most quantum systems. But entropy being given by area is not just a fact that's true about black holes. So we can make a just a very nice schematic argument to show why this is true. So suppose we had some region of space-time with some boundary area A, but I had some super entropic objects. So in that region of area A, I could put degrees of freedom that had entropy much larger than the area measured in Planck units. Then all I have to do is throw in some extra mass into this region, and I can collapse it to a black hole. And so I'm left with some object whose entropy is now just the area over measured in Planck units. And so what I have is some loss of entropy. I have a violation of the second law of thermodynamics. And so the black hole entropy is something that I should really think of that puts an upper bound of the entropy in any region of space. And this is something I think that is a very profound feature of gravity. It's something that we can use to derive actually Einstein's equations themselves. So thermodynamics are not just some peculiar feature of general relativity. They really contain the exact same information. So the holographic principle was not derived from microscopic physics. It resulted from infrared or thermodynamic behaviors of black hole, and so black holes. So it's something that's true in any consistent theory of gravity. I think holography seems like the most profound feature of gravity, and I think then it seems much better to work with a theory of gravity where the most important characteristic of that theory is really built into the microscopic description, that we really want to study gravity using a theory that is explicitly holographic. And so while I think one of the old goals of quantum gravity might have been to understand what is the ultraviolet completion of gravity, I think perhaps a better way to phrase a new goal for quantum gravity is to understand how gravity emerges from a more ordinary quantum system that lives in one lower dimension. For such an approach to be sensible, we're required to understand already some UV-consistent theory in which we expect to see the gravitational dynamics emerge. It seems beyond our reach right now to construct a model that describes our universe, that describes a theory of gravity with positive cosmological constant. But it is possible to construct ultraviolet complete theories of gravity that are slightly different from our universe, that have negative cosmological constant. This, of course, is the object of study in gauge gravity duality, where we learn that certain quantum field theories are precisely equivalent to a theory of gravity in one higher dimension. You might think about these as toy models for quantum gravity because they're really theories that are live in, you know, a universe that has negative cosmological constant, but they're rather sophisticated. I think in these theories that we obtain through gauge gravity duality, it's really a complete theory of gravity. It has all of the same observables and dynamics that we'd want to see, and so there's no truncation to something simpler that's not as interesting. These are really models of quantum gravity. So our best understood examples of gauge gravity duality are certain conformal field theories. What are these conformal field theories? Well, consider a conformal field theory that has a large central charge whose correlator is factorized. So if I take a correlation function, say, of a small number of single trace operators in the theory of simple operators, then these correlation functions will factorize into their lower point functions plus connected contributions that are suppressed by the central charge. Also want a theory whose spectrum of conformal dimensions is sparse. So at low conformal dimension, I have, say, some simple operator, and then I have all the necessary product operators that I build out of taking the right normalized product of that operator, and I have just these very simple operators until order C, when I have a much more dense spectrum. So these types of CFTs that satisfies these criteria, there's been very strong evidence given that these are a sufficient set of criteria to give you a conformal field theory whose bulk has a good description in terms of some, you know, local effective field theory coupled to gravity. So to understand that, one can really see that this first criterion is roughly the statement that the curvature scale of my gravitational theory is very large when measured in the Planck scale, so I have a good classical geometry that emerges. The second statement, that the correlators factorize, is really the thing that determines that my gravitational theory has some good description in terms of perturbative effective dynamics. The sparseness of the spectrum is just the statement that in this conformal field theory that the low energy operators are really just the operators of my effective field theory and their multi-particle states and their bound states. That's what all of these product operators are. And then, you know, this very dense spectrum at order C are really the black hole states that contribute in that theory. And so if we consider some state psi in the CFT. So here I'm thinking just about a 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT, so some state in the gauge theory. It also describes some geometry in this gravitational theory. And what I want to try to understand is how do I look at this state in the gauge theory, and how do I see the emergence of this dual gravitational geometry? The gauge theory lives on the boundary of this bulk spacetime, and so in my talk I'll often use the words bulk for the gravity and boundary for the CFT. In the case where this state is the vacuum, I know what this geometry is. This geometry is just the maximally symmetric negative curvature space, anti-de Sitter space. And another very nice feature of this duality is that when I talk about descriptions that are near the boundary, they correspond to sort of ultraviolet localized excitations in the conformal field theory. Well, things that are sort of deep in the center of this geometry correspond to sort of long length scale infrared dynamics of this conformal field theory. So I think this gauge gravity duality is very powerful. It contains a complete theory of quantum gravity. But I'd like to make an analogy and say that gauge gravity duality is really like having Siri for quantum gravity on your phone.
BlackBerry Assistant,
yes. So we might want to ask BlackBerry Assistant what's inside a black hole. And so the gauge theory really does have the answer to any question that we ever want to ask about quantum gravity. So in the same way that Siri has sort of complete access to the entire content of human knowledge on the internet. You may have found, though, in talking to your telephone that that does not appear to be the case most of the time. And so it can only give us answers to the questions that we know how to ask. So we have to be able to phrase them in the right way. And so even if we completely solve the gauge theory, even if I could tell you every correlation function in the CFT, we wouldn't actually know the answers to the questions we want about quantum gravity. And so Siri and the gauge theory, I think, are both pretty rudimentary in speaking the correct language. Siri in understanding our questions phrased in English, and the gauge theory in understanding our questions phrased in the gravitational language. And so the real problem of quantum gravity in holography is that we need to figure out how to translate questions from the language of gravity into the language of gauge theory, where we can go and calculate the answers, hopefully. This is a difficult thing to do because the natural languages on both sides are not very compatible. The natural object to work with in the gauge theory is a local operator. So these are ultraviolet operators, and so they don't naturally see very far into the bulk geometry. They're really sort of best thought of as confined on the boundary. At the same time, the natural objects to work in the gravity theory, you might think they're local operators. But of course, gravity has no local operators, no different variant local operators. So you need to then do some more complicated scheme of fixing some quasi-local operator. And you have to specify this quasi-local operator in the bulk in terms of some complicated boundary conditions on the CFT cylinder. And so these are not natural objects going the other way either.
Can I ask a question? These O's, you call them single trace operator. What does that mean technically?
So in most examples that we understand very well, we can think about this as being some, say, gauge theory, some matrix gauge theory. And so these simple operators are just, say, traces of simple operators. So that's a language I implicitly use. You should just think that these are low dimension operators whose correlation functions factorize in the way I said. And those are the things that are interesting. So that maybe that this single trace language is maybe a little confusing, so I apologize. Sometimes it just slips into the way I speak about these
so
theories.
When you say natural objects in the gauge theory are local, do you just mean to say naively this is the person you look at? Or do you might want to mention that non-local things like Wilson loops are secretly expressible?
Yeah, so I mean the natural things that you'd be tempted to work with when somebody gave you a quantum field theory is to work in the basis of local operators. That's in fact how almost all calculations are done in ADS-CFT. You're of course right that there are other very simple things, for example, Wilson loops, that one might also be tempted to work with. And so there is already part of the gauge gravity dictionary established for Wilson loops that says that they're dual to minimal surfaces. And this is very related to the type of story that I'm going to tell today. So what are my requirements for a new language, a better way of organizing our dictionary? Well, if I want the gauge theory to speak back and forth to my gravitational theory, we want to find the sort of simplest words and grammar that organize our translation. And they look natural on both sides of this dictionary. And so in the gravitational theory, I want things that are diffeomorphism invariant. If they're not, they're not going to be good observables in the gauge theory. So they'll necessarily have to be sort of non-local gravitational objects. And in the gauge theory, I also want some non-local variable that's not living on the boundary, that's not ultraviolet, that it naturally sees the infrared geometry. And I'd also like at the same time it not to be some crazy complicated Wilson loop type object, that I want it to be a very simple natural object, to transform simply under the symmetries of the theory. So what I'm going to do in this talk is describe exactly this type of foundation for a better dictionary that's going to allow, I think, an easier translation between conformal field theory and gravity. It's a language that's very much still under construction, and so what we're laying out right now is the foundation, not a complete holographic dictionary. But we can already see that it's a very powerful framework. And so there's been lots of interesting ideas discussed in, say, the last 5-10 years in understanding how gravity emerges from the gauge theory. And this is a powerful framework because it brings together many of these familiar ideas all under one roof. And in fact, many times, these ideas are actually much simpler to derive or explain using the language that I'm going to explain to you today. So for example, there's been a lot of discussion over the entanglement first law and how to derive Einstein's equations from using the entanglement entropy in the CFT. So this can be very naturally described in our language. People have been very interested in how to compute conformal blocks, so the building blocks of a CFT, using a bulk construction that goes under the name geodesic Witten diagrams. So this is actually sort of an immediate consequence of the types of ideas I'm going to talk about today. People have spent a lot of time trying to construct the sort of effect of local perturbative degrees of freedom in the bulk geometry. People call this the HKLL construction for its authors, Hamilton, Cabot, Lifshitz, and Lowe. And so we can actually find a very nice re-derivation of their construction of local bulk dynamics, but it does it in a more useful basis. And finally, especially here at Perimeter, there's been a lot of interest in describing de Sitter dynamics for variations of entanglement entropy. So this is another thing that fits very naturally into our framework. So let me tell you about what I'm going to do with the rest of my time. Outlines usually are meant to tell you what's going to happen, but I've given them very cryptic names, which is not so useful, so let me explain. If we're going to talk about building a better gauge gravity dictionary to understand sort of non-perturbative questions in quantum gravity, we should really at least spend a little time discussing whether or not this is a useful, important thing to do. Is this a wise use of our time? And I think it is very much so, and so I want to defend this as a very useful avenue to go down. Next, if I'm going to construct this sort of new, better dictionary, it's often very useful to look back to the past, that often there's good ideas that have been forgotten. And so I'm going to find a parable from some forgotten physics from the 1980s. And finally, having done that, we're going to use it as motivation to kind of finally teach our gauge theory to speak in a naturally gravitational language. So any questions about that broad overview before I continue on to the next part of my talk? Okay, so why bother with quantum gravity? Maybe this is a little bit like coming to Toronto and saying, why cheer for the Leafs? Maybe there's not a single person in this room who needs convincing of this question. But I think sometimes our defense of quantum gravity is a little lacking. That we, when you know our experimentalist colleagues challenge us on what we do, that we don't have a good retort, and I think we can build a better response for them. And I think it's one that might lead to very interesting physics, especially in our new gravitational wave observatory future. So, you know, if we're interested in quantum gravity, it's good to know when we expect the effects of quantum gravity to be relevant for our theory. And since it's very hard to calculate this explicitly, we can just use dimensional analysis to try to get some estimate of when we expect, you know, the loop contributions to be important. So there's only one scale, at least, that we're certain of in our theory of gravity, Newton's constant. Oh, that should have a negative. That's a very different theory. When it has a negative, we can just do dimensional analysis and find the Planck length, and the Planck length is 10 to the minus 35 meters. That's a very small number. just to put it in perspective, here we all live at about 1 meter. There's atomic physics at 10 to the minus 10 meters. The LHC is 10 to the minus 19 meters. Then we go a whole ways down this logarithmic scale all the way to 10 to the minus 35 meters where we find quantum gravity. And so I think if anyone is really interested in, you know, seeing experimental consequences of quantum gravity at 10 to the minus 35 meters, I have a good approach for that. I think you should go and find someone to cryogenically freeze your brain and hope that in a few centuries, maybe a few thousand years, that these will be achievable. And this is really the only reasonable research plan for studying effects at 10 to the minus 35 meters. This is really, I think, hopelessly small. And this is the type of criticism maybe those of you who also work on quantum gravity have heard before from your friends in experiment. If we don't expect to see these effects, what is the point in studying quantum gravity that we can never test? Well, we've neglected one important fact about gravity, and that's that the warping of space-time can shift excitations all the way down from the Planck scale to observable scales. So of course, many people are interested in, you know, quantum gravity effects early in the evolution of our universe that are, you know, blown up to large scales by inflation. But one particular case that I think is interesting is that radiation from near a massive object is obviously redshifted as it escapes the gravitational potential. And the strongest such redshift is produced by black holes. So radiation produced from near the horizon of a black hole can be redshifted all the way down from Planckian energies before it escapes away and reaches us at very low energy. And so we might want to ask, can we use make use of this very interesting fact as a tool to study quantum gravity? So thankfully, black holes, as you all know, are not so black. In the hot 1970s, Hawking showed that black holes evaporate away quantum mechanically by emitting radiation. So let's take some quantum states. So let's take a bunch of hard drives from a quantum computer that contain an enormous amount of quantum information. And now let's collapse them below the Schwarzschild radius. We form a region of high curvature and singularity, possibly, and some event horizon. So one, I think, very interesting feature of quantum field theory in space-time is that observers don't agree on whether a state is the vacuum. So we might have some observer who's falling through the horizon. He will see this horizon as being an empty, vacuous place for just the fact that gravity is universally attractive, that you can't store energy on the horizon without it falling into the black hole. You know, this is the idea behind the no-hair theorems for black hole, that any structure on the horizon has to collapse. And so we can decompose the quantum state sort of at the horizon in sort of the natural Rindler basis of that vacuum. And so it has this structure of an entangled, a thermally entangled state. And it's exactly this thermally entangled state that looks to some observer far away from the black hole as actually an excited state, a state that is thermally radiating. So this is kind of how we can see Hawking radiation, where these, you know, distant observers are really just like the Rindler observers with respect to the flat space at the horizon. Of course, this black hole radiates with some temperature that's like 1 over its mass. So for purposes of expository simplicity only, this is no argument I'm going to make who's going to rely on this, we can think of these Hawking pairs as just, you know, some pair of qubits in the state, this sort of Bell pair state, so a pair of maximally entangled qubits. So you can think maybe you've just sort of truncated that thermal spectrum down to the first two, the lowest two energy eigenvalues. But this is really just a narrative simplicity that I want to use. The important part is that this outgoing Hawking radiation in the real thermal state and this toy state that I'm talking about is very much largely entangled with its partner inside the black hole. And so there's sort of no way to write this as a product state between the field inside and outside. And so when the black hole is almost radiated at late time, so I can take some nice slice at late times through the black hole, there's an enormous amount of outgoing Hawking radiation that is all entangled with its ingoing partners inside the black hole. And so the state sort of roughly has this form. It's just some tensor product of a large number of maximally entangled qubits. And then the black hole disappears. So schematically, we have an evolution that begins with my pure state, all this quantum information in my quantum computers that I collapsed into the black hole. And then at late times, what comes out is some outgoing radiation that's in a mixed state. It's in this thermal mixed state. And so this radiation, moreover, is, to good approximation, rather featureless. It contains some small amount of information, say the temperature or the charges, all the conserved charges of the black hole. But it does not contain, using these effective field theory calculations, any information about the state that I threw in. So we have information loss and a violation of unitarity, that there is observables in this state that have been lost to the state in the future. And so the basic issue is that using effective field theory, using the arguments of Hawking, thermal entangled radiation is emitted for the lifetime of the black hole, and so the entanglement entropy of the Hawking radiation just continues forever. It continues to increase. But in a unitary process, eventually the entanglement entropy is zero because this state is pure. And so at some point, this curve has to turn over. Eventually, in a unitary process, that the Hawking radiation, the bits that are emitted from the black hole at late times, are not maximally entangled with things inside the black hole. They don't generate more entropy. They're actually sort of entangled with things that have already come out, and they start to decrease the entropy. So I think it's kind of obvious that at late times, these two curves are very radically different. So you won't be saved by taking small corrections to your effective field theory doing, you know, Hawking's calculation and ever find that this curve turns all the way over down here. These are very radically different. So one of the great things about gauge gravity duality is that we learn that gravity is a good theory of quantum mechanics, that the CFT is a perfectly good quantum mechanical theory. And so we know that time evolution has to be a unitary process. So we know that the late time state is just some rotation of the early time state. And so this is completely incompatible with Hawking's argument for information loss. You might think perhaps the discrepancy is subtle for observers, and so we can try to see what happens if we assume unitarity and run the evolution backwards. The important thing to recall, and this is just going to be a very schematic argument because I don't want to dive into the details, this is just sort of a launching point for a different story, is that it was the thermally entangled state that really was the Rindler vacuum at the horizon. That was the thing that allowed the infalling observer not to see a lot of energy as they pass through the horizon. And we just argued, you know, the unitarily evolved state is very different from this thermally entangled state. And so in the in frame of the infalling observer, the state at the horizon is not at all close to the zero energy vacuum state. Because I don't really understand non-perturbative quantum gravity very well, I can't actually tell you what someone's going to observe as they fall through that horizon. All I can tell you is that unitarity requires a failure of physics, sort of physics as usual. It requires a failure of the reasoning of low energy effective field theory. So we can call this failure a firewall. One possible interpretation of this is that, you know, space-time is actually torn to pieces near the horizon of the black hole. If I interpret this state sort of very naively, it looks enormously high energy. And so I think, you know, one version of the firewall is that the interior of the black hole just sort of crumbles away. There is no space-time and geometry ends. For a large black hole, of course, the curvature of space-time is very small at the horizon. And from the equivalence principle, it's largely indistinguishable, at least using local measurements, from, you know, any other point in space-time, that the event horizon really is not a very interesting place, one thinks, using the naive arguments of general relativity. So if I had told you that a firewall had appeared near the singularity, where, you know, curvature is Planck scale, this would be nothing unexpected. If, you know, I was excising some sort of small part of the black hole interior, nobody would get upset. But a firewall sort of near the horizon of a black hole is really an effect of quantum gravity that's now observable at low energy. And this is really, I think, a crisis in our understanding of what we're doing. This is an enormously surprising effect. And in order to deal with it, in order to explain what's happening, one necessarily has to give up something very precious to you. There's no way out. So you can give up on locality, perhaps. You can, you know, relax effective field theory. Some people even think the best way around it is to sort of change the measurement theory in quantum mechanics to abandon the Born rule. Instead, they try to invoke new principles. So there's lots of ideas like error correction. People talk about how entanglement is really just a wormhole. There's an enormous list of names that could go down here that could talk about these ideas, but it would take an entire slide. So I hope those authors will excuse me for not citing them. But there is a very deep problem here, and it's a deep problem that requires us to give up something that's dear to us. So I think one can interpret this crisis in two ways. The first is just saying we're doomed. And so we don't know what we're doing, we've lost control of our calculations, we don't know why, and probably we should just move on. But I think the right way to look at this is that we could never have hoped to be so lucky. You know, 10 slides ago, we were worrying that quantum gravity is something at 10 to the minus 35 meters, and now I'm telling you that there's an effect of quantum gravity that's visible at a length scale that is the black hole horizon, that's visible at astrophysical scales. And so there's a problem, you know, in these astrophysical scales that we need to solve, and it depends on what we decide the nature of quantum gravity is. And so if we discover the right answer, it's possible that with powerful enough tools to study black holes, we might even be able to measure these effects. And we might even be able to measure them without falling into a black hole ourselves. We don't have to be the infalling observer. And so I am hopeful, perhaps, that the precise gravitational wave spectrum of a black hole, say in some merger, so something that we might detect in future LIGO-like experiments, you know, it will depend on the geometry near the horizon, and maybe the effects that are necessary to solve this information paradox will be measurable in these future detectors. And so I think, you know, this is my justification for why I want to think about gravity, why I want to think that it's a very important question, but I don't yet know how to choose the right solution. So what I can't do for you now is make some prediction. Instead, what I want to say is we really need to think a lot harder about how geometry emerges in much simpler situations where the stakes are a little lower. So to do that, I want to bring up a parable from some forgotten physics. But before I move on, I'm going to do something very risky and ask if there's any questions about firewalls. Under the condition that there's a large category of those questions that I am going to politely defer to the future.
Yeah, what are the experimental signatures of firewalls?
No, I mean, there are no known experimental signatures of firewalls. And that is my whole point, is that there is some failure. It's a failure at astrophysical scales. It's a failure that is demanding us to give someone an experimental signature, and yet we don't have the slightest clue how to calculate it. And that's because you know, the different predictions all result from some different choice of some fundamental principle to give up, you know, that I'm going to, well, we've ruled up giving up unitarity. Maybe you have to give up effective field theory at low curvature. Maybe you have to give up locality. There's a lot of people, you know, dear colleagues of mine at Stanford who want to give up on quantum mechanics in some sense or another. Right? They want to invoke new rules. But I don't think I'm going to convince the majority of this room that any of those are the right thing to do yet. And so it's, I think, too early to make predictions. I think what one wants to do is have a group of people who are thinking very hard about how geometry emerges in situations that are less complicated than studying black holes. And there should be, you know, one should be able to sort of match these calculations using sort of an effective field theory of the near horizon region of a black hole to, you know, observational signatures. And so if, you know, maybe I want to make some sort of model independent parameterization of the possible deviations from GR in the near horizon region, and I want to use these to build, say, let's surround my black hole by some membrane, which is sort of my boundary conditions for my GR simulation outside, and so I can build some sort of model independent parameterization of what could go on there and its signature on this membrane, on these boundary conditions. And then, you know, in the future, people will calculate what they think, they'll try to figure out how quantum gravity works and sort of put that into that framework, and now there's an apparatus that exists there to translate those into, you know, the spectrum of gravitational waves somebody might see from, you know, a black hole ringing down.
Yeah, so suppose these signals that people are obtaining and will continue to do don't show any particular interesting feature. So then what would you give up?
Well, I mean, what we advocated for originally when we sort of advocated for a firewall was, you know, the complete collapse of the space-time in the interior of the black hole. But we were very cautious and conservative, and we said that that would be inobservable unless you crossed the horizon. So, you know, you can do rather dramatic things that aren't easily visible to the outside. I think, you know, how well motivated those are is an interesting question. But there's certainly many things you can do where you push your disaster sort of as far as you can and hide it behind the black hole horizon. And there's always some tension, sort of The more you push the interesting physics toward the horizon, the more dramatic it gets. But the more you can kind of hide it, if you try to make it less dramatic, if you try to make the deviations from GR weaker, you also kind of have to push them farther away from the horizon in many senses.
So I want to ask a question about the upper bound for the entropy. Like you said, the black hole gives an upper bound for the entropy of the space-time, right? Yeah. But what happens after the black hole evaporates through Hawking radiation? Will the entropy go up and violate the bounds?
No. So when a black hole evaporates, it's a very diffuse gas of Hawking radiation, and so it's no longer confined
in some small area.
What if we just combine, so consider the space-time as a combined area, and the black hole will evaporate, and then we calculate the entropy in that area, so will that violate the bound for open?
My statement is that there is no such process, that there's no black hole that's going to evaporate into some box such that it has entropy that's greater than the area of the boundary.
Why
can't
you have a black hole box?
You can put a black hole in the box, but it's the, you know, it's confined in the box, and the number of degrees of freedom are really the number of degrees of freedom in that box. And so it's the size of that box, which is the ultimate limit on the number of degrees of freedom you have. So that's the upper bound on your entropy. So let's go through a parable from some forgotten physics. I think this is actually very beautiful physics. It's physics maybe not everyone knows, and so we'll take a little time going through it. So I want to learn some lesson for how to organize my gravitational dictionary into these non-local, gauge invariant operators, and I can do it from thinking about gauge theory. So we typically formulate a gauge theory in terms of some gauge potential, A, and the corresponding field strength F. Where the equation of motion is just that the gradient of F is zero, classically. But the inclusion of gauge field is really a redundancy of the description. Right? They're not all physical degrees of freedom. And so I think it's unfortunate we have to use this very inefficient representation of the physics, that we're carrying around a lot of extra machinery that really wasn't necessary. However, we do have a complete set of gauge invariant observables in gauge theory. These are the Wilson loops, so I can take I'm going to call psi the trace of a path-ordered exponential of the gauge field, and I'm going to call w its expectation value in the vacuum. So a question that one might want to ask is, can you express the dynamics of the gauge theory in terms of these Wilson loop invariables alone? Can I give you the equations of motion without ever making reference to the gauge field itself? So that is, what I want to do is not talk about spatial gradients of fields, but I want to talk about spatial deformations of loop. I want to talk about equation of motion that uses derivatives in the space of loops. So how do we insert the equation of motion into a Wilson loop? So let's take some Wilson loop on some curve C. First, what I can do is make this sort of box-like deformation of my Wilson loop. And so this box is like inserting the field strength into the Wilson loop. And then I can sort of take a derivative where I push that along my Wilson loop, and this sort of acts like taking the gradient. So I can turn this into equations. I can take the functional derivative of my Wilson loop with respect to the path. And what this does is it just pulls down a factor of the field strength. Again, this is a functional derivative with respect to the loop. So this is a derivative in loop space. It's not a derivative in position space. And then I can take I can take a second derivative. So there's two contributions for the second derivative. One, where they act at different places on the loop, and so you pull down two powers of the field strength. And then there's a coincident term where they overlap. And that second derivative and the coincident term is what gives you the gradient of the gauge field. It gives you a contribution as you push this along. And so I can define this sort of second derivative operator where I just do this tiny integral over the interval around this coincident point. So I just integrate from minus epsilon to epsilon where these two derivatives happen at the same point. And what I get out is the insertion of the gauge field equation of motion into my Wilson loop. So we now have the classical equation of motion written purely in terms of Wilson loops. It's just saying that this second derivative of the Wilson loop is zero. I can actually do better, so I can actually go and find the correct quantum equation. So I can consider the Schwinger-Dyson equation, which I get from just the variation of the path integral where I've inserted the Wilson loop. There's one contribution from varying the action, which of course is just my equation of motion. There's other contact terms I get from doing the variation of the field where it acts on the Wilson loop itself. And so I can. Pardon?
Is E0 on the left downstairs?
Oh, the coupling
constant.
OK. So we can,
again, rewrite the left-hand side using the loop derivative, the second derivative that I just defined. And so I get a complete equation of motion for the expectation value of the Wilson loop. It kind of has two contributions. So this right-hand side has a delta function. So I only get support when my loop crosses itself. And then it breaks into two contributions. It sort of has this two-point correlator of the two separate pieces of my loop, and then a one-point function of the original loop. It's actually an equation that has a very nice simplification at large n, where this term just disappears, and I just get the product of the two expectation values. And it's an equation that I can actually solve, actually most easily by doing kind of a Fourier transform into loop momentum space and specifying some appropriate boundary condition. But these are equations that you can solve, and they generate the perturbative contribution to the Wilson loop. So what's very nice is that I can also define a Laplacian on field space and a Laplacian on loop space. Here is a Laplacian on field space. It's just the second variation of the field integrated over all of spacetime. Here is a Laplacian I can define on loop space. It's just this second derivative I defined before, but integrated around the loop. And now the loop equation can be written just like this. The loop equation is just that the loop Laplacian plus the field space Laplacian are zero. So they're equivalent to each other. I can write this equation where if I view the Wilson loop as some loop transform of the gauge field, it's kind of a map from the gauge field to Wilson loops, then what I'm saying is that there's a commutation relation for this loop transform and my Laplacian. We say they're intertwining operators. So I can act with the field Laplacian and take the Wilson loop, or I can act with the loop Laplacian on the Wilson loop afterwards. And these are equivalent operations. This is a very nice way to understand what these loop equations are. And so I think these loop equations are very conceptually very pretty. They contain the full dynamics of the gauge theory. They'd never talk about the gauge field itself. They are a little singular and hard to work with. And so it is true that none of us learn gauge theory this way. Maybe you heard them as an aside, but certainly nobody began to teach you that way. But I think perhaps this idea's time just hadn't come yet. And perhaps it was just being applied to the wrong theory. So we might re-express our search for the correct language for quantum gravity in this kind of loop space language. But I want to know, what is the right loop space for gravity? I want to know, what are the right loop operators, and what are the loop equations for bulk physics? And what do the loop equations and loop operators look like in terms of the dual gauge theory? So typically, we've thought about ADS-CFT as taking the CFT state and calculating the geometry, or calculating observables directly in sort of real space geometry. And I want to sort of add an auxiliary step in between, where what I want to advocate is that the most natural thing to compute using this gauge theory are actually the observables in this loop space. And I can use this loop space as sort of a step in between the gauge theory and the local real space physics that I want to describe. Any questions about the loop equations and gauge fields?
So when you talk about loops in quantum gravity, you still haven't told us what loops are.
No, I have not told you what loops are yet. So what we're going to do is sort of figure out, how do I rearrange the observables of my gravitational theory into this language? So what is my loop space? What is the right set of loops? I need to understand, there's many different types of observables that have this flavor to them, and what are the right sets? So maybe I'd think that I want to take, geodesics that live in my gravitational geometry. Maybe I want some sort of surfaces, say codimension 2 surfaces or codimension n surfaces. Maybe I want some surfaces that are anchored on the boundary. What are the right set of loops for my theory?
Well, those like these that aren't anchored on the boundary, as we alluded to in the beginning, are difficult to specify in a diff invariant way, because we need to specify them in terms of boundary data far away. And so it's unlikely that they'll have a simple representation in the gauge theory. So we want to look at things like this. And if they are boundary anchored, we really like it to be sort of simply specified in terms of those gauge theory boundary conditions, in terms of the geometric boundary data. So what is something that naturally satisfies this? Thankfully, I don't have to come up with the right solution by myself. There's an example of the type of construction we're searching for. It's already been found. You may have heard of it under the name the Ryu Takanagi proposal. And so what Ryu Takanagi connects is they tell us that if I take some spatial region in the gauge theory and calculate its entanglement entropy, then it is dual in the gravitational theory to the area of some minimal surface. So this suggests that minimal surfaces anchored on boundary regions are things that are very natural to calculate in my gauge theory. And so they'd make a very, you know, intuitive choice for my loop space. So the lesson is that the CFT sees the bulk geometry naturally through these codimension 2 minimal surfaces. The boundary conditions naturally are the codimension 2 surfaces in the CFT. One might want to sort of immediately think, oh, well, the relevant loop space is all possible space-like surfaces in the CFT, or, you know, in space-like codimension 2 surfaces in the bulk. But this is an enormously redundant space. There's an infinite number of shape deformations that I can make on these. And so you might think this is way more data than I need. My bulk is just a D plus 1 dimensional space. It's not infinite dimensional. However, the space of spherical regions is a D plus 1 dimensional space. I have D centers on the boundary and 1 dimension for the radius. And so this is sort of a natural conjecture dimensionally that has the same amount of data as the local bulk geometry. So what I'm going to do is define our loop space to be the space of minimal surfaces with spherical boundary conditions. But because I'm not doing gauge theory anymore, I'm doing gravity, I'm going to rename loop space. I'm going to call it kinematic space. And so this is my new name for loop space. It's actually a familiar object of study for some mathematicians. It's the one of the primary objects in a field called integral geometry. We can ask, what does kinematic space look like? We're going to consider a very simple example. We're going to consider, for the rest of this talk, ADS3, where minimal surfaces are geodesics. This is a story that naturally extends to higher dimensions, but I don't want to talk about that with my remaining time. So I want to think about some geodesic that lives in my bulk geometry. It's specified by an ordered pair of space-like separated points on the CFT. And so I can use these as coordinates that label all of my geodesics and my geometry. And now I'm going to define kinematic space to be the space of these ordered pairs of points. So it's the space of x left and y right. And each of these points corresponds to a geodesic in this space. What we want to do is try to assign some metric to our kinematic space. So the metric on kinematic space should be invariant under the isometries of the geometry. It shouldn't depend on my choice of frame. And actually, this uniquely fixes the metric when we consider, say, a very symmetric state, like the ground state for anti-de Sitter space. So I'm going to change coordinates a little bit. Instead of talking about x left and y right, I'm just going to think about some light-like coordinates that form the causal diamond of these two points. And I can talk about, say, the center along one of the light-like coordinates, q, and the center on the other light-like coordinate, q bar. And then they have corresponding half widths, l and l bar. And in these coordinates, what I get sort of uniquely fixed by conformal invariance is this very simple metric. If you look at this metric, it might be very familiar to you. This is one copy of de Sitter space, two-dimensional de Sitter space. And this is another copy of two-dimensional de Sitter space. And so what I get just sort of out of my my invariance under isometries is that kinematic space for the vacuum is the product space of de Sitter across de Sitter. It's kind of a peculiar space. It actually has two time-like directions. But that is actually not a problem for what we're going to be doing. In some cases, we do understand already how to specify a metric on kinematic space, even when it's not fixed by symmetry. Although the right way to do this is still sort of an area of active research. In many cases also, one can prove that these geometries are equivalent, that there's an invertible map between real space and kinematic space. And so specifying for you my kinematic space and my kinematic metric is equivalent to having told you the real geometry and the real metric. Again, this is an an area of very active mathematical research. These types of problems go under the name boundary rigidity and lens rigidity. And so there are not a lot of theorems about when this is invertible, although there's lots of conjectures that very often it is.
So can I ask you a question? Is the idea that if somebody gives me a two-dimensional surface and tells me the distance between any two points on that two-dimensional surface, then you can construct the three-dimensional geometry that surrounds the two-dimensional surface?
So if I give you some three-dimensional geometry, and I give you the distances between any two space-like separated points on the boundary, that is sufficient data to reconstruct the geometry in many cases. Yeah. So we're trying to reconstruct the bulk geometry using just the distances of points on the boundary. So what we do want to do is we want to generalize Ryu Takanagi, though, to describe all of the bulk physics, right? I don't want just to know what loop space is. I also want to know what my Wilson loops are. I want to know what are the right observables to reformulate the gravitational physics.
I'm sorry. So are you saying that any choice of distances that I give between points give me a consistent three-dimensional geometry, or is it a one-to-one?
No, actually, no. So
something that I'm not going to tell you in this talk is that if you take all possible space-like separated points on the boundary and define a function on that space, it actually is a much larger space than the space of geometries. And so the image of the space of geometries obeys some constraint equation. So actually it's understood. So for example, what's understood is that if you define a function on ADS3, you define a function on the kinematic space of ADS3, and you want to ask if it's the image of some function on ADS3, then there is a constraint such that that constraint holds if and only if it's a function in real space. These are called, in the literature, they're called John's equations, if you're ever interested to look them up. So we can think of the areas as integrating the unit operator over the minimal surface. And so a natural generalization is just to replace the unit operator that gave the area with some arbitrary operator that I'm interested in my bulk gravitational theory. So this bulk surface operator is a non-local and diff-invariant pro with the bulk geometry, and so fits very nicely into our paradigm. In the case of when we had this 2D boundary that we're talking about, this is actually a well-known operation. It's called the X-ray transform. So let's just look at, say, one of the spatial slices. I can think about some particular geodesic. I'm going to label it by its angular half-width alpha and its center angle theta. And so I'm going to define some function that lives on my space. And I can define the X-ray transform as just a function that is a function of the center and half width. It's a function on my kinematic space. And the value of the function is just the integral of my real space function over the geodesic. So this function is the value at this point. It's called the X-ray transform, maybe quite obviously, because if you know the function here is, say, your bone density, you know, my geodesics are just the paths of x-rays, and kinematic space is really just thought of as the x-ray image of the function or the operator in my space-time. You might worry that the kinematic description really only sees some projection of the gravitational theory, just like an x-ray is some projection of your body. But we don't actually have only one projection of the bulk data. In some sense, we have it from all possible angles. And so reconstructing a complete 3D image, reconstructing the full extra dimension, is actually a well-understood problem. It's not something we had to invent, because you can go to your favorite hospital. In the US, I say you spend a lot of money. Thankfully here, that's not true. You spend some very small amount of money. And now they take the X-ray source and they rotate it around you from all directions. And you get an image like this. You reconstruct the complete 3D map. And so this is, you know, called computed tomography. And so this is something that we can just sort of import the techniques that have been discovered in this mathematical field, in this medical field, to reconstruct physics of the extra dimension in the bulk. One way that it's very easy to see why this is possible is that the X-ray transform has very nice properties under isometries of the geometry. So let's take some function, which I'm sort of just labeling by this gradient on my space. And I want to think about its X-ray transform across, say, this geodesic. And now I want to look at the action of some isometry. But I'm just going to separate out the function and the geodesic. So I'm going to act just on the geodesics with this isometry. So say I do some rotation. I rotate my geodesic this way. And this operation, this rotation on geodesics, is entirely equivalent to instead leaving the geodesics fixed and taking the function, the points, and rotating the opposite way. So, you know, rotating a geodesic this way or a function this way has the same action on these integrals. It's, you know, it's like a passive versus active transformation. So what this allows me to write is that the Laplacian that acts on a function in real space can be moved, it can be commuted across the X-ray transform, and it becomes the Laplacian that acts on my kinematic space. And so I have, just like I did in my loop space interpretation of gauge theory, I have an intertwining relation for my Laplacians. And so what intertwinement allows me to do is to take, say, some equation of motion for a free scalar field. I can now use intertwinement to move the equation of motion from acting in real space to acting in kinematic space. And I can write down an entirely equivalent equation of motion where this is now the kinematic space Laplacian. And so now I really have some sort of loop equation, some loop equation of motion for my free scalar field. And it has the structure of sort of a very simple dynamical equation, just a free scalar in kinematic space. I can do the same thing with the linearized Einstein's equations. So here is the linearized Einstein's equation. And I can use intertwinement to rewrite this as some equation of motion in kinematic space. So this is the loop equivalent of Einstein's equation. And it's just a very simple scalar equation of motion in kinematic space. So you can see that intertwinement allows me to rewrite my dynamics in terms of loop equations.
That's the question. That's only true in some gauges. So I guess what happens to the gauge?
Oh, yeah, so I chose some particular gauge here. What's actually very interesting is that this is a longitudinal transformation of the tensor. And so it has some kernel. And so it actually projects out gauge transformations. I mean, at the end of the day, the length of a geodesic is something that's gauge invariant. And so this equation doesn't depend on your choice of gauge. It's just a statement that this transformation projects out gauge transformations. And so it doesn't, I can rewrite this equation in any gauge I want. I just chose the sort of transverse traceless gauge to make this very simple.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to understand is, so are you saying that you reconstruct the geometry in a particular gauge or somehow, because I mean, obviously you cannot do it exactly, but you're saying independent of the gauge, this equation is always valid.
Yeah, so
this is kind of the Lorentz gauge that's on the top.
This doesn't depend on any gauge at all. It's just a statement that if I do some variation in the metric, what is the change in the length of all geodesics? That doesn't depend on any gauge, and it completely specifies for me the gauge invariant deformation in the geometry. I can't reconstruct you some particular choice. I mean, the reconstruction problem will give me an equivalence class of diff-related variations in the metric. Because this map has a kernel. That kernel is precisely these diff transformations. So we found a natural set of gravitational variables that are non-local and that contain all of the information that I would normally specify using sort of a local differential description of the geometry. But we haven't succeeded yet unless these appear naturally in the dual gauge theory. So to understand what their gauge theory interpretation is, I want to consider some quasi-primary operator in the CFT. It has some conformal dimension delta. Now I want to expand the product of two of these operators using a local basis of operators. And this is sort of one of the beautiful facts about conformal field theory, is that I have this sort of radial evolution operator about any point, and so I can take this product of operators, you know, and there's an operator that evolved this back to the center, and it allows me to rewrite this product as sort of some infinite sum over operators just at the origin. This is called the operator product expansion, and there's a very typical way of grouping this where you group it into quasi-primary operators and the contributions of all of their conformal descendants by acting with derivatives. What's sort of very useful about this arrangement of the data is that that the different coefficients that relate the conformal descendants are entirely fixed by conformal symmetry. And so there is no dynamical data in this function here. The entire dynamical data is specified in the spectrum of operators that appear and the OPE coefficients. So the coefficients with which they appear in this expansion. You know, I should say that, you know, this OPE is a very natural thing to think about in the CFT. It's kind of the whole magic behind the bootstrap, and it's, you know, one of the fundamental principles in how we talk about conformal field theory. I'm going to find a more compact notation for this expansion, where I'm going to take this contribution of some entire conformal family, and I'm going to call it B. I'm going to call it the OPE block. So this is an operator OK and all of its conformal descendants. So the OPE block carries coordinates of 2 points. And so we might naturally identify it now with some loop operator living in our kinematic space, which was the space of 2 points, the boundary conditions on the CFT. And so let's consider a very simple, a scalar block with some dimension delta and spin zero, and we'll try to characterize this field. We might, you know, how does it transform? Well, if I do some conformal transformation, it just transforms very simply, and so this transforms like a scalar operator. And then I can ask, what is its equation of motion? So this conformal family is an, you know, an eigenoperator of the conformal Casimir, that its commutator with L squared is just some constant, this delta, delta minus d. And so I can try to now represent the action of this conformal Casimir by some differential operator that acts on the 2 points. And what I find is that it is just the kinematic space Laplacian. And so I have an equation of motion for my OPE block. That is, this is just the kinematic space Laplacian plus its conformal Casimir is equal to zero. And this is precisely the wave equation again for another scalar field propagating in our kinematic space. And it's exactly the same wave equation that was obeyed by a bulk geodesic operator that was dual to this operator OK, that this bulk integral has the same equation of motion. In fact, I won't tell you in this talk, but they also obey the same boundary conditions and satisfy the same constraint, this constraint that I alluded to your earlier question. And so what we have established, they have the same equation of motion, they have the same boundary conditions, they have the same constraint. They're necessarily the same operators, that the OPE block is really the same as this geodesic bulk operator. This is a story that I told you here in terms of geodesics and OPE blocks. It's a story that has a natural extension in the language of surface operators in higher dimensions. It's also important to note that these are really sort of equivalent and they're suitably variant non-local building blocks on both sides of the duality. Both of these are non-local, and both of these are defined entirely invariantly. They don't depend on a choice of gauge or a choice of, you know, diffeomorphism. So I am very short on time. This suggests it might have been your fault. It actually was probably my fault, so I'm going to skip some things. So this is a very nice construction. You might ask where to go next. So far we've been primarily occupied with a story that was kinematical. It was about representations of conformal symmetry, you know, and choosing the appropriate variables to study our problem. But we also need to understand how to incorporate dynamics and interactions into this picture. So this can actually be done very easily for interacting fields. It's something that we've already made a lot of progress on. It's slightly more complicated to incorporate interactions from gravity. But actually here, there's an enormous benefit that while the bulk picture might be confusing, the gauge theory OPE is actually something much better understood. And so we can use the structure of the operator product expansion to sort of tell us how to organize the gravitational corrections, the gravitational interactions to these geodesic operators. We also still need to understand the kinematic space equivalent of the full nonlinear Einstein's equation, not just the linearized equations that I described in this talk. And once one has understood these things, I think one is then finally ready to, once one really sort of has this solid picture of how gravitational physics emerges in these non-local variables from the OPE and the gauge theory, I think then we'll be ready to turn our tools back to black holes. And perhaps there is some very interesting signal waiting for us there. So to summarize, understanding quantum gravity is a difficult problem, but one that we should still care about. And we should care about it because our naive understanding of quantum gravity breaks down at the horizons of black holes at astrophysical scales. And this might lead to effects that are measurable one day. And so to make progress, what we really need is to make use of, I think, the deepest and most surprising fact about gravity, and that is that gravity is holographic and emergent. So we have a very powerful model of holographic duality. It's gauge gravity duality. And the problem is that we really, at the present moment, don't have a good translation dictionary. We don't know how to take our questions in gravity and phrase them in a language that they correspond to some operator question in the gauge theory. But we can build a better dictionary to do this. And so we can use a non-local basis of surface operators in the gravitational theory and a corresponding basis of OPE blocks in the gauge theory. And these show, I think, an enormous amount of promise that they're going to be a simpler and more intuitive organization of this dictionary. And just to give you an outlook about where we are now, I was actually reading, I went back and saw when Einstein put out his paper on GR in 1914. This is actually, 1914 was, I guess it was seven years about after he first formulated his equivalence principle. So you might wonder, what was happening in those 7 years between having, this beautiful physical insight and finally writing down the theory that we know. And Einstein wrote in that paper, in recent years I have worked, in part together with my friend Grossman, on a generalization of the theory of relativity. During these investigations, a kaleidoscopic mixture of postulates from physics and mathematics has been introduced and used as heuristical tools. As a consequence, it has not been easy to see through and characterize the theory from a formal mathematical point of view. And so he said the primary objective of the present paper, this present paper where he introduces the machinery of differential geometry, is to close this gap. And I think it's fair to say, if you hear lots of talks here, I'm sure you do, on emergent gravity and gauge gravity duality, that there really is a kaleidoscopic mixture of ideas that are tossed in. And people talk about information theory and entanglement entropy. Now I'm telling you about integral geometry, there's lots of thermodynamics. And it can be, I think, similarly hard to see through and characterize the right theory that is hiding here. And I think perhaps the shift from differential geometry, which has been phenomenally successful for a very long time, but maybe needs to be superseded with a non-local approach using integral geometry. And this might be the tool in the present day that closes our gap in understanding gravitational physics. So thank you.
What do you think is going to happen if you try to use this dictionary to attack, the horizon of a black hole? So you have this, this mapping between the space of, the kinematic space and the real space, 3D, and 2 plus 1D space, more realistically. So what's going to happen at the horizon? Is the idea that these physics don't penetrate the horizon, or it's higher dimensional, four dimensional surfaces don't penetrate the horizon?
Yeah, so there's a large gap in understanding between the things we can understand right now and understanding the geometry near a black hole horizon. So in particular, the black hole horizon is probed, say, by things that are not actually minimal geodesics. So often there are things that are winding geodesics, so the surfaces that may wrap around the horizon. Or in particular, things that go and penetrate through the horizon. And so I think there actually are very natural extensions of our ideas that start to talk about these objects. They're not minimal geodesics anymore, even though they are distinguished classes of locally minimal surfaces or geodesics. And I think there are, in some cases we already know, there are natural gauge theory operators that describe them. And they have a very simple interpretation in terms of the OPE. So I don't know right now what is the right observable still that's going to tell me about geometry behind the horizon. But I'm optimistic that this is a profitable path to get closer and closer to the horizon. And as we do that, we're going to learn a lot more along the way.
So if I can continue on that. So imagine there is you can transfer the local bulk observer into some observable, or some local bulk observable to some observable in the boundary, which is not local, presumably something as complicated. So I guess the idea is that the farther you get from the boundary, the more non-local it is in this observable. So what do you imagine happens at the observer crosses the horizon?
The types of operators that we use to describe these geodesics actually look like local integrals over some causal diamond in the boundary. And as you get closer and closer to the black hole, these become infinitely large. They're actually going to wrap infinitely many times around the CFT cylinder. And so they're going to become measurements that you make over an arbitrarily long time. So you can already see that there is something like certainly elements of complexity and very complicated non-local operators become important in how you understand this physics.
Okay, let's thanks James again.